I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Today, you'll hear the story of a forgotten Baltimore judge, buried more than a century ago in Greenmount Cemetery, who deserves to be remembered. His name was Hugh Lennox Bond, and he was ahead of his time. His progressive activism on and off the bench helped blacks after the Civil War and challenged white resistance to Reconstruction in Maryland and in the South. We'll have that bit of history for you in the second hour of today's show. Up front, we follow up on news. Mental illness, guns, and mass shootings. A Baltimore congressman challenges the Republican obsession with Benghazi. Then, Maryland biologist Harry Spiker talks about the growing population of black bears in the state. Another busy Midday Friday starts after the news from NPR. And welcome to Midday Friday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us at WYPR. Today on the show, a bit of fascinating history for you. A look back nearly 150 years to the time of Reconstruction after the Civil War. Historians have always portrayed Reconstruction as an era of corruption and bad government brought on by radical Republicans who wanted to punish the South for the Civil War. But our second hour guest today, historian Douglas Edgerton, says the opposite was often true, that Reconstruction was the first progressive era in the history of the country. And one of the most progressive activists at the time was a long-forgotten Baltimore man, a Baltimore judge, Hugh Lennox Bond. He deserves to be remembered, and we'll hear about him when Douglas Edgerton joins us after the news at 1. Between now and then, we'll cover three stories and issues. Reporter John Fritzy of The Sun talks about Baltimore Congressman Elijah Cummings and his ongoing battles with Republicans in the Congress over their insistence on prolonging what already has been a lengthy investigation into the 2012 attack in Benghazi, Libya, that left four Americans dead. John will be joining us soon. We'll also hear later in this hour from Maryland's top bear biologist about the growing numbers of black bears in the state, where they live and where they roam. They're apparently roaming to the east from Maryland's most western counties, Garrett and Allegheny. That's coming up later on in this hour. Up front, we want to start our show by revisiting the subject of guns and mental illness, prompted, of course, by what happened 1 week ago in a small town in California near the University of California at Santa Barbara. A killing spree perpetrated by 22-year-old Elliot Roger left six people dead, 13 others wounded. Three of the victims were shot to death. The massacre ended with Roger taking his own life. Since that rampage, one of the victim's fathers, Richard Martinez, has been pleading with the public for more action on gun control.
I can't understand why we aren't doing more to prevent this kind of thing. Here you got a guy who they knew. You know, there's all, I don't know whether it's the family or the police or who, but I mean, aren't we tired of this? Isn't this just, I mean, how can this go on? I mean, what are we thinking? It's just unbelievable to me that we have to do this all over again.
Richard Martinez, the father of one of the victims in that shooting. Yesterday, the U.S. House of Representatives approved a measure that would boost funding for the nation's background check system. Here with me now to discuss that and other gun control strategies again is Daniel Webster. Daniel Webster, based here in Baltimore, one of the nation's leading experts on gun violence prevention. A researcher, he studies policy, he studies state and federal laws. He directs the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research and has been with us before to talk through these things. Daniel Webster, we welcome you back to Midday.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Yeah, you know, we're just listening to Mr. Martinez's voice there and what he had to say. Of course, he's very, obviously very distressed by what's happened. He's lost a son. You know, in situations like this, I know maybe we shouldn't focus too much on the details of any one particular case, but you almost can't help it. You do wonder what could have been done in the absence of a previous history of violence by this young man or any previous history of mental illness, parents who are were troubled or worried by his behavior but unable to get their son committed to treatment or even to make him take medication. It seems like, you know, a big question mark. What could have been done?
You're absolutely right regarding this case and current law that was in place, whether we're talking about federal or state laws in California. I do think there is one type of law that could potentially have been relevant here. It's actually a law that's in place in states as diverse as Connecticut, Indiana, and Texas. And in those states, they have something that you can think of as a gun violence restraining order. And it operates in some ways similarly to a domestic violence restraining order, a civil protection order, where someone goes before a court and asks for a temporary action, restraint, placed upon an individual due to their threat. To others or to themselves, and in a short-term way, firearms can be removed from such individual so that there's adequate time to fully assess the relevant danger in going on there. And one could imagine that in the case of Elliot Rogers, that something like that would have given him a little more time. And perhaps they would have been able to discover that he had many hundreds of rounds of ammunition stockpiled and seen some of his other postings and other warning signs and taking action.
So that would be for someone, that's very interesting, someone who maybe isn't prohibited now under current conditions or current laws, but brings you into the gray area where parents or someone express concern to a judge, and then a temporary order is issued.
Exactly. The volatility and dangerousness that emerges in some of these cases, particularly with mass shootings, sometimes it's over a relatively short period of time. And whereas a month ago, someone generally would have been safe, so to speak. But in essence, they're in a downward spiral. And so a policy like this, again, totally temporary in nature, I think does a nice balancing of individual rights against public safety. So you're not barring someone from life for life forever purchasing or possessing firearms, but you're giving the state and law enforcement an opportunity to come in, assess the situation so that we prevent tragedies.
Well, you're calling for, Dan, there, discretion and judgment left to a judge, left to law enforcement. And right now, would you say, and I realize in asking this question that there are as many different state laws as there are states, but would you say the prevailing prohibition in most states is someone who's been involuntarily committed for a mental illness or for treatment, someone who's been convicted of a crime? Does it go beyond that?
Yeah. Is that generally? The main categories here. The most common prohibitor, of course, is a felony conviction. Mm-hmm. There are other criminal convictions. Again, this, as you said, varies by state, but there are other criminal disqualifiers, including domestic violence misdemeanors, restraining orders for domestic violence, for example. It's generally the same categories. I think another area that we've been focused on, and there was a group that formed last year called the Consortium for Risk-Based Firearm Policy, which I'm part of, but it had a diverse group of mental health experts, gun policy experts, legal experts, clinicians involved in trying to tackle this very challenging problem. And the consensus that we came to is that firearm restrictions should be based upon dangerous behavior and less than, not so much on a diagnosis. The vast majority of people with mental illnesses are no more a threat to be violent against others than anyone else who doesn't have those conditions. But there are a subset due to often a constellation, not only the mental illness, often involving substance abuse and other issues, that create the danger. Many of these individuals actually do have convictions that disqualify them. So we called for, this consortium called for sort of a broader way to look at this issue, so that we look at, for example, disqualifying for misdemeanor crimes of violence, as well as repeated patterns of drug and alcohol-related crimes, which are a huge red flag for substance abuse. And again, hardly ever in these gun discussions do people talk about substance abuse, but it's huge. It's a very substantial part of the problem.
And what about someone who's undergone outpatient treatment, or someone who's been, just in that category? Would someone who's just gone through outpatient treatment fall under that, or would there still have to be some other evidence of danger?
Oh, clearly it has to be evidence of danger. The last thing we want to do is, in essence, you know, create a penalty for people seeking care.
Yeah, right.
Really, again, the consensus is that it is not that you have a mental illness, but it's are you acting in ways, do you have a history of violence, recklessness, that really is a red flag and a warning that it's better that you not be in possession of firearms, at least temporarily.
Yeah. Dan, you mentioned Connecticut and Indiana. These are places where police have some discretion about removing guns from people they think are dangerous?
Yes, absolutely. When it comes to their attention, whether it's cases that they're called to, emergency situations that they're called to, which, you know, when I talk to law enforcement, they say it's a all-too-common scenario, you know, they see situations where someone is clearly in a mental state in which the last thing they need or anyone else needs is them to have access to lethal weapons. And so they have authority, again, on a temporary basis to remove firearms so that there's a thorough assessment of the situation. Those situations can subsequently lead to an involuntary commitment for treatment for their conditions, which may then lead to a more lasting firearm prohibition. But again, these things emerge very quickly, and in our opinion, we need to give law enforcement the tools to keep people safe in the short term during these crises.
Daniel Webster, I want to ask you a question about the news item I mentioned from yesterday, a vote in the House of Representatives passing an amendment. 260 to 145 was the vote to provide an additional $19 million in funding for the NICS, the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. One could call it our gun check system. But we don't actually have, in the United States, we don't really have universal background checks, do we? I mean, that's been something that the National Rifle Association has fought off for several years.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think most experts who study this issue would concur that that's our single biggest flaw in our current system designed to keep guns from dangerous people, is that the majority of states lack requirements for background checks for all gun sales.
Yeah, and that being the case, I wanted to ask you one more question today. The reason we're talking about this today is because of another shooting in this one in California. And states have moved ahead and, of course, enacted gun control laws. But because guns can and do move across state lines, you know, you would think federal regulations would be the ideal, but we don't have that. But state-level laws do have some effect in some cases. You cited today Connecticut and Indiana. So there is hope at the state level for restricting guns in some way that would make the public safer.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I've done research on this very topic, and clearly, again, we see guns move from states with the most lax laws towards states with far stricter gun laws. Having said that, we still see a benefit for the states with the comprehensive laws to keep guns out of the hands of criminals and other dangerous people, because there is a cost associated with that interstate trafficking, and not everyone is able to make the connections with interstate traffickers, to obtain firearms. So it's not as if these state laws are useless. They do appear to reduce availability of guns to dangerous people. But as you said, we would have a far more effective system if those protections were in federal law.
Daniel Webster is one of the leading experts on gun policy and a gun researcher in the United States. He directs the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research, is the co-author of Reducing Gun Violence in America. Thank you very much for being with us again today, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, and you can read an article about that very idea that he mentioned, a gun restraining order idea, on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. It's posted there now. It's a Christian Science Monitor article in which Dan is quoted. We'll take a break here. When we come back, John Fritzy, my colleague from the Baltimore Sun, joins us to talk some national politics. Representative Elijah Cummings solidifies his role as what Politico calls the Democrats' Benghazi warrior. Martin O'Malley, with Maryland's governorship pretty much in his rearview mirror, heading for Iowa next month. And Representative Andy Harris joins the chorus of critics of the Veterans Affairs Office. A short break on Midday Friday. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan Roderick's here. House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi appointed Representative Elijah Cummings of Baltimore to lead Democrats on a controversial select committee to investigate the 2012 attack in Benghazi, Libya, that left four Americans dead. Elijah Cummings is already the ranking Democrat on the House Oversight Committee, where he's often taken up for the Obama administration and pushed back hard against Republican-led investigations of the IRS and the attack on the U.S. diplomatic mission in Benghazi, which occurred while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. Joining me now to talk a bit about this and some other national political stories, John Fritzy of the Baltimore Sun, who covers Congress. Hello, John.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good.
So this is a very interesting turn of events in the last few weeks here, what's happened with this. The Republicans obviously want to keep this investigation of Benghazi alive. So even though they've had hearings on the Oversight Committee, chaired by Darrell Issa, they've established this second select committee. And the Democrats weren't pleased about this. In fact, some Democrats wanted to boycott this select committee, right?
Yeah, I mean, Democrats feel like this is a political effort, as you said, to keep this in the news, particularly because this is a painful episode for the former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, who many believe will seek the Democratic nomination for president in 2016. And so Democrats view this as look, this thing has been looked at. It was a terrible situation, but there wasn't really much that leaders in the Obama administration could have done to prevent it or to address it once it happened. Republicans see it very differently, and they feel like the Obama administration, sort of covered up in the days after this attack happened in 2012 as part of a campaign strategy. So they feel like there's a lot more to probe here. Cummings is just a natural player to lead the Democrats on this committee. He has been, I think Democrats and some Republicans would agree he's been very effective combating Republicans on this issue and other issues as the ranking Democrat on oversight. The health care law, the IRS scandal, and this and a number of others. He has been pretty effective at changing the story or allowing Democrats to kind of get a foothold in to make arguments against the Republicans on all these issues.
Right. And it's been a very contentious relationship between Elijah Cummings and Darrell Issa, the chairman of that oversight committee. This goes back to March. This well-publicized incident during a hearing on the IRS when Elijah Cummings wanted to speak and Darrell Issa, the chairman, wanted to adjourn and move on.
Chairman, I have a statement. I have a procedural question, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, you cannot run a committee like this. You just cannot do this. This is, we're better than that as a country. We're better than that as a committee. I have asked for a few minutes to ask it. And I wanted to ask a question. What are we hiding? What's the big deal? May I ask my question? May I state my statement?
You're all free to leave. We've adjourned, but the gentleman may ask his question. Thank you.
If you will sit down and allow me to ask the question, I am a member of the Congress of the United States of America. I am tired of this.
John, of course, you remember this. Now, I have to bring it up to date here, because Issa, who's wanted to, lead these investigations into Benghazi and has already had these four hearings. What's the politics of this here? I mean, why did John Boehner establish a select committee? Just to keep the whole thing going, or to give it more credibility because people don't trust ISA anymore? They feel like ISA's on a, you know, a vendetta of some kind?
I think all of those are possible. I mean, certainly there are Republicans within the conference who are frustrated with Darrell Issa, particularly because of exchanges like this. And this is also a perfect example of where Cummings capitalized on a mistake, really, by Republicans to turn the story into nobody remembers what this committee meeting was about. And all they remember is this exchange. And this image, there's an image that came out of that hearing with Mr. Cummings speaking into the microphone and Mr. Issa sort of slashing his throat, saying, cut off the mics, cut off the mics. And
right.
This image is a very compelling image that is still run in stories, weeks later. And so I think there is some frustration among Republican leaders that this kind of thing has happened, where the message that they wanted to get out, in this case dealing with the IRS scandal, the Democrats, including Cummings, were able to sort of distract from that message and paint ISA as overreaching. And so I think that may be part of the calculation for leaders in supporting the select committee. You know, another potential political calculation may be that it gives a little more weight. These select committees are relatively rare, and so it brings a little more attention to it. Whether it's a political effort, as Democrats say it is, or a real look into what happened, as Republicans say it is, we'll find out.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting that the Democrats decided, rather than just boycott the committee, to put Elijah Cummings on it, because there'll be no fooling around now.
I think that's right, and I think his ability to be effective in that role will depend a lot on how Republicans handle it. If there's a sniff of politics, he's going to call that out, because that's what he's been doing all along. Not to say what he's doing isn't political too. It's political all around. But if it's run, it'll be interesting to see how he approaches it. If the panel is run, very by the book, and there aren't big headlines coming out of it until the end, sort of where his ability will be to get in there and make points. But that just remains to be seen.
Yes. And John, and one more interesting development this week, Darrell Issa subpoenaed Secretary of State John Kerry to come in and talk about this, right?
Right. This is the thing. There's a little bit of internal struggle going on here with the Committee of Jurisdiction, Darrell Issa's committee, and then this select panel. There was a lot of tea leaf reading into, why is Cummings on this panel but not Darrell Issa?
Right.
And for all of these things that we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
But Darrell Issa is continuing and has said he will continue to sort of do his part of the investigation, and the subpoenaing of Secretary Kerry was certainly a big part of that.
It's pretty odd, too. Here's Elijah Cummings with Wolf Blitzer on CNN. Wolf Blitzer is asking about what's going on here. ISIS committee has issued a subpoena for the Secretary of State, yet there's this select committee that's supposed to be investigating Benghazi.
I think the speaker has lost control of ISIS. Mr. Issa is trying to interject himself into the select committee's business. Keep in mind, well, when the select committee was formed, what the speaker said was everything comes under the select committee. And now here we have Mr. Issa trying to bring the secretary in. And the secretary is saying, you know, I'm going to come, but I'm just going to come one time. This is it.
John, we'll keep an eye on that one. Another member of Congress from Maryland, Andy Harris, the only Republican member of the delegation, this week talking about joining the chorus of critics of the Veterans Affairs Office because of these revelations about the quality of care and the length of time it takes veterans to get treated through the Veterans Affairs Veterans Administration, Veterans Affairs Office. He's saying that when it comes to medical care, we ought to consider privatization for veterans. Can we talk a little bit about that, what Andy Harris had to say?
Yeah, it looks like a sort of a voucher system, although I'm sure they would not want to use that. It's a sort of a dreaded term these days. But essentially that the government would subsidize veterans to be able to seek medical care through private hospitals and so forth. The idea has gotten a fair bit of attention, largely because of what's going on this week, particularly today with the VA. It's unclear to me whether Mr. Harris is going to introduce an actual bill on this or whether this is just an idea he'd like the committees of jurisdiction to pursue. But it isn't, Harris gets some attention in part because he is one of a small handful of folks who are doctors and veterans. And so I think that's part of the reason why it's gotten a fair bit of attention. And, of course, it's coming in the middle of this big blow up at the VA. Whether this actually takes hold, I think, is maybe a little more questionable. I think right now the VA is trying to get its act together on a more basic level. Maybe this is something that could be looked at, down the line.
Right. And we heard from Steny Hoyer on this. Of course, he sees the Republicans as politicizing this scandal.
Yeah, I mean, look, both there's charges and countercharges of politicizing this. You've got Republican groups like Crossroad GPS, former Karl Rove group, running ads in Senate races in Alaska, sort of pointing this out. There's charges of fundraising off this and so forth. Both sides politicize this to some degree. You see the Democrats calling for the secretary's resignation are all running in states where they have difficult election efforts, right? So in Maryland, neither of our senators are up and all of the House members are pretty safe, there were not these calls by Democrats or even Republicans. Andy Harris, state's only Republican, was not expressly calling for Ashton Senecki's resignation. So,
right.
There's politics, of course, on all sides of this. And both sides will accuse the other of playing politics with the issue.
And John Fritzy, one more political story I wanted to talk with you about here is Martin O'Malley, the governor of Maryland. He's making plans or is already traveling since the General Assembly session ended in April, continuing to raise his profile as a possible presidential candidate.
Yeah, don't let anybody tell you this guy's not wanting to run for president. He's going to be in Iowa next month. He's going to be in New Hampshire before then. He's going to be in Nebraska. These travel hits are coming one after the other, and they've really picked up pace since the General Assembly session ended this spring. He's a little more free now to do this, and he is absolutely picking up the pace. I would not be surprised at all to see a significant picking up of the pace of fundraising. All this is happening, of course, while former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is also getting more active. This book of hers has come out, and she's doing more publicly visible. And so I think, again, what the governor's trying to do is just maintain his ability to run should Clinton decide not to run. And I think he is doing everything he should be doing. What remains to be seen is whether it'll be impactful. He's still polled pretty low in these early states.
I'm curious about something, John. Have you talked to anybody about what Martin O'Malley does with himself if, most people expect Hillary Clinton to run? As you said, her book is out today. And by the way, Politico got its hands on the chapter she devotes to Benghazi. And I think I tweeted that out a little while ago. Have you talked to anybody about, what does Martin O'Malley do in the meantime? What happens to him if he can't really run for president until 2020, I guess, right?
You know, I asked him about this in an interview. A few weeks ago, sort of, you know, he said publicly that he's thinking about running for president, which I think everybody acknowledges is true. And I asked him, well, are you thinking about anything else? And sort of anticipating maybe there were other ideas he could do. And he didn't really have any, which sort of tells me that there really aren't any other ideas
okay.
right now. I think he will run. If Hillary Clinton runs and she is as strong as everybody thinks she will be, then you know, he may run against her for a while. He may be looking for a VP slot or a cabinet secretary slot. You know, these are things he could do to sort of you know, stay relevant and stay in the mix. And he's a young guy. I mean, he can run in the future. So if he doesn't run successfully in 2016, it's not like it's over for Martin O'Malley.
John Fritzy, my colleague from the Baltimore Sun, thank you for your time today, John.
Thank you.
See you. John Fritzy, reporter for the Baltimore Sun. The June 24th Maryland gubernatorial primary is just a few weeks away, as you know. In fact, I just wanted to mention this. In June, during the week of June 16th through 20th, we'll be devoting an entire week of programming to the governor's race and the attorney general's race. Each candidate for governor, Republican or Democrat, will be here. They'll get an hour to themselves to answer our questions, and we'll have a debate of the Democratic attorney general candidates as well. So that's all going to happen in one big fat week of midday politics, June 16th. Through the 20th, you'll get to hear from the candidates and ask them questions. And if you're looking before then for a good online source of information about the candidates, their positions, you should check out the website vote411.org or 411 vote411.org. That's the League of Women Voters of Maryland's Candidates Guide. You just put in your address and your zip code, and it gives you all the information you need about where to vote and who you'll be voting for. Lois Hebel is with us, the league's co-president. Lois, nice to have you on the show today.
Thank you.
So I'm glad we got this rolled out on the website. We put a link to it on my Facebook page, and we tweeted it out for you today.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And as I said, I did it this morning. All you have to do is put in your address, your zip code, and they'll tell you so you know where to vote and where you'll be eligible to vote, right?
That's correct.
Now, is the league putting out a printed version of this? Because you always do.
Oh, yes. Yes, we definitely, each of the counties that has leagues has a printed version in there. Ours is in Baltimore City is distributed through the Pratt Libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the leagues put it in some kind of local papers, like I think in Montgomery County, it's in the Beacon Press. And then a PDF of the printed guides are on the state website, which is lwvmd.org.
You know, we're at a place we've never been before, a June primary. We talked about this the other day. This is pretty early, and I guess people are, I think that week that we have in mind, you know, for that we're scheduling these candidates to come in, that's a good week. I think that's people won't actually be focused on this.
Right, and we're very concerned that either people don't know there's an election or they're just apathetic about it. They think it won't make any difference,
but there's a lot to vote for.
There is definitely.
There's the statewide candidates, governor, attorney general, comptroller. Uh-huh. There's on all the legislative districts.
All the legislative districts. We've been having forums, inviting them.
Yeah, there's the House of Delegates, the state senate. And the League of Women Voters, do you have chapters still in each county?
Well, it's not every single county, but it's like 14 or 15 counties.
But half of the counties.
But the vote411.org covers information on all the counties. I think even one important office that people may forget about is the state central committees, too, because these people, the Democratic State Central Committee, if there's a vacancy, they are the ones who recommend the replacement
for House of Delegates.
For House of Delegates, yeah. And we didn't have enough room on our printed guide to do other than any more than list them. But if you look at vote411, you can see if they answered our questions.
How's the league doing generally? Now you said they're in 14 or 15 out of the 23 jurisdictions in Maryland.
Right.
That's pretty good. You know, some people say, is there still a League of Women Voters?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And you know, we have managed to increase our membership somewhat.
We've
been working on that.
That's excellent.
But I know we still need to work on our outreach and make sure people know about us and know that this is available.
Well, that's why we have you here, Lois Hebel. Lois Hebel is co-president of the League of Women Voters for Baltimore City. And again, wherever you live in Maryland, wherever you're listening to us, you can use this website.
That's correct.
Vote411.org if you're not sure about where to vote or who you're voting for, because some of the districts changed.
That's right. Right? And there is a place on the first page that says show districts, and it will tell you what your districts are. But of course, they automatically come up from your address when you're looking at the candidates.
Right. And we have debates coming up, more televised debates in the gubernatorial election coming up this coming week, I think.
That's we're co-sponsored with the WMPT debates.
With MPT?
Right.
And I think WBAL TV's debate is coming up.
Well, I don't think we're involved with that
one. Okay, but there's another one. There will be another opportunity to see these candidates on television. So pay attention, folks. Only 3 weeks to go. June 24th.
That's right.
Just a little
over
3 weeks. Thank you, Lois.
You're certainly welcome.
Thanks for being here. Another break on Midday. When we come back, we're going to talk about Maryland's top bear biologist about the animal's comeback, the black bear in Maryland. If you have questions about this, if you live especially in Frederick County, Washington County, Allegheny County, questions about living with bears, concerns about them, or if you're just a naturalist and you have questions about the comeback of the black bear, give us a ring for the next segment of our show here, Midday Friday, 410-662-8780. How do you like that? I had a little moment there. 410-662-8780 in our email address. I have some emails to read. Midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back. Coming up in the second hour of Midday, some fascinating American history from after the Civil War, including the story of a forgotten Baltimore judge whose progressive activism, on and off the bench, helped blacks after the Civil War and challenged white resistance to Reconstruction in Maryland and in the South. Historian Douglas Edgerton on the Wars of Reconstruction, after the news at 1. Welcome back, everyone. Dan Rodericks here on Midday Friday. Some emails to read. One off our discussion this hour about the shootings in Santa Barbara. This one from Sean, who says, it is a tragedy about what happened in Santa Barbara, but more gun control is not the answer. California has some of the strictest gun control in the U.S., and it did not stop a mentally ill young man from obtaining a gun. Before he used a gun, he murdered three people with a knife and a hammer, but everyone is focusing on the lives he took using a gun instead of focusing on the real issue, mental health. He should have been committed to a mental health facility. Unfortunately, our country has turned its back on the mentally ill. Some other emails from earlier in this week. We had a conversation the other day about what makes great streets, a great conversation with Klaus Philipson. Not all great streets have to be super wide like the examples you cited here in Baltimore with median strips or where previously trolley cars ran. This is an email from Art in Baltimore. Also included can be streets full of historical and attractive buildings, some up-down topography. An example of such a great street here in Baltimore, Charles Street, from Saratoga Street in the south to Chase Street in the north, especially centering around Mount Vernon Place. Certainly agree with that. Our discussion of boulevards is just one citing one example of what makes a great street. And here's an email from Ed about following up on our discussion about wildlife in Baltimore City. He said, I recently listened to your show about birds in urban areas. My family lives in the edge of Herring Run Park near Bel Air Road. I try to go on daily walks in the park. On one walk, my wife and I saw a juvenile scarlet tanager. We thought it might have been an orchard oriole, but after a little more study, we concluded juvenile scarlet tanager. We see hawks, herons, and all sorts of birds. The bats have started coming out at sunset. The deer population is at an all-time high. We have lived here for some 25 years, and over the past 2 or 3 years, the deer population has exploded. Last night, we saw two young deer with a fox about 25 to 50 yards behind them. Just a couple of days ago, I saw my first black snake about 4 feet long and an inch and a half in diameter. The city, says Ed, is alive. So if you have emails or comments to share with us that way, midday@wypr.org. And speaking of wildlife, the black bear has been making a comeback in Maryland. In the 1950s, Maryland's American black bear population was down to about a dozen. But through hunting bans and other environmental legislation, the bear population began to increase from those paltry numbers. In 2004, the number of bears was estimated at about 500, and the Maryland Department of Natural Resources reinstated legal bear hunting with a two-day hunt and a quota of just 30 bears. Today, the black bear population in Maryland is estimated to be around 1,000 and rising, and the bears have been scaring and delighting people in, of course, Garrett and Allegheny counties, the western counties of the state, but also apparently they're moving into Frederick County as well. We have a chance now to speak with Harry Spiker, who is Maryland's chief bear biologist, a leader of the Black Bear Project at the at Maryland's DNR, the Wildlife and Heritage Service. Harry, thanks for joining us on the show.
Oh, my pleasure, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Hey, how do you make estimates of the bear numbers?
Well, population estimates, they're actually pretty difficult to do because a bear roams so far. Their home range is anywhere from 10 to 50 square miles. So we actually put several stations throughout their range with a scent attractant, something like molasses, and collect hairs from them, which we then undergo DNA analysis, and we can then estimate a population size from identifying those individuals.
Mm-hmm. And
so we do that about every 5 or 6 years.
I was going to ask you, every 5 or 6 years then. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, that it's too cost prohibitive to do it every year.
That estimate of 1,000, you're pretty confident on that?
Yeah, that's a pretty solid estimate. And what's just as important as the estimate is we have several trend indicators, several surveys we do annually, which indicate, you know, whether the population's increasing, stable, or decreasing. And when all those indicators match up, then it really gives us a pretty good picture of what's going on.
I was looking at that photograph from the Washington Post the other day of Jeff McAfee, who works with you at the Wildlife and Heritage Service.
Right.
And he had a 6-week-old bear cub in his hands, and he was examining it, and then, of course, returned it to its mother. And that's all cool to do. I mean, I know you guys do this. I just always have wondered, does that have any effect at all on the mother's relationship with that cub, that those cubs are going to be okay even if humans touch them, you guys touch them briefly?
Yeah, absolutely. And when we're doing that, the sow is fine with that. The sow is actually under a dissociative anesthetic at the time, so she's immobilized just as if she were undergoing surgery in a hospital. So she has very limited memory of what happens there. And the cubs are small enough that they don't imprint to the people. I mean, we're in there for a short period of time. We're in there for about 45 minutes with them, and then we're out, and the sow and cubs are back together at that point, and their life goes on as normal.
And, Harry, we know about bears in Garrett and Allegheny counties, and I mentioned Frederick, maybe Washington County. Are you seeing black bears there as well?
Absolutely. And we've had them there in small numbers for years. I like to say that our bear population is like a wave moving from west to east across the landscape. Right now, the crest of that wave is over Allegheny, but we've definitely got growing numbers in Washington, Frederick. And we're to the point now we see dispersing bears throughout most of our central and a lot of our southern counties as well each year. And those are basically the young teenagers just going out looking to find a territory of their own.
Here's a question for Harry Spiker. I have one by email and one on the phone. This is Bonnie in Washington County. We'll take her call. Bonnie, go right ahead with your question for Harry.
Yes. Hello, sir. Hello, gentlemen. Hi. Thank you very much for taking the call.
Sure.
And I live actually on the way eastern side of Washington County outside of Boonesboro, Maryland. And we're right up against the Frederick County line, the Appalachian Trail. And we've been blessed, actually, to have two different bears visit us. And we know there's two different ones because the one was a really big bear and pretty much granddaddy. And then we have a younger one that we think might be only 2 or 3 years old. Well, my question was, the first time we saw the larger bear, he was actually limping. He was walking on his right front paw. It was bent at basically maybe the lower joint. And we called and reported that to DNR, and they just said, oh, don't worry about it. They're resilient. You know, he'll be fine. And I guess it just took me a little bit by surprise that they wouldn't want to come out and check and try to, you know, check on the health of the animal.
We're very interested in the health of the animal, but from the description that you gave, if the animal was mobile, at the time, it's very unlikely in a practical sense that we could actually get there and get to that animal to see it. And so we're more interested in sightings, observations at that point, because we do have, we have several, several species of animals, bears included, where we get reported. I think automobile collisions is the most common culprit there. But they will get along just fine with three legs. It's not that we don't care about that individual. It's just that it's very impractical for us to try to get there and examine that individual animal.
Harry, the bears that you see or that are sighted by the public and reported to you generally seem to be healthy and carrying a good body weight. They have enough food?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've got a very healthy population. Our bears are healthy. And that's really reflected largely in that picture that you saw with Jeff McAfee holding that cub. That's one of the more important trend figures we look at, is how many cubs are being born. And we've got some of this whole mid-Appalachian region here, which Maryland is a part of, we've got some of the biggest litter sizes in the country right here. And that's just indicative that the habitat's really good and the population is healthy.
What's a big litter, Harry?
Our average is three cubs per sow every other year. They give birth every other year. We handle several every year with four cubs.
Here's a question from David by email. Would I be in trouble legally if I shot a bear that was raiding my garbage can on my property?
The quick answer to that is yes. There are other ways to deal with that, and we're happy to work with him if he wants to give us a call. But basically, locking up your trash is key. Maryland law does allow for folks to shoot a bear to protect themselves, people, or animals on their property. But there are usually much better solutions that we can help people get to.
And this is an important question for anyone who's listening. It's spring, headed to summer. Folks will be going out to Western Maryland to hike. You'll be going to the state parks, maybe a state forest, Potomac Garrett, places like that. And you're wondering, what do I do if I see a black bear, maybe a sow with a cub this time of year? So, Harry, take it away. What's your advice to folks?
Absolutely. In a nutshell, treat it the same as you would a stray dog. Always make sure you leave it an escape route. Do not run, because bears, just like dogs, have a chase reflex. If you run, it may trigger that chase reflex. But bears really are pretty apathetic toward people. They're not aggressive by nature. So I tell people, if you see a bear and it does not react to you, in other words, it doesn't know you're there, enjoy the view and then back out. And if the bear does know you're there, then just remain upright, talk in a calm voice, back out. And usually, once the bear hears a person, it turns tail and runs the other way.
Okay. And someone told me that one thing you don't want to have happen, and even though it can be accidental, is to get between a sow and the cubs.
Yeah, there's definitely some truth to that, Dan, although I actually think that warning is actually a little overrated. We make our living crawling into these dens and getting between the sows and cubs.
Right.
If anybody out there that should have been eaten up and spit out by a bear, it would be me. I'm still here. But no, it's good sense that if you see a bear and it's cubs, yeah, definitely. That what you don't want to do is startle it. So if you're out hiking in thick brush, I recommend you make some noise. And the other thing you definitely don't want to do is to feed it. We get a lot of people that think it's cool to get a photo opportunity if they throw some food to the bear. That draws bears in toward people because they learn quickly they can get food from them.
Right.
So that's like the worst thing that people can do.
Harry, it's been nice talking with you.
Same here. Thank you.
Yeah, I hope we get a chance to do it again sometime and follow up. It's pretty interesting. Interesting project, the Black Bear Project at the Maryland Department of Natural Resources Wildlife and Heritage Service. That's Harry Spiker, who is our chief bear biologist for the state. That's our Midday Friday. First hour has already gone by and is finished. We take a break now for lunch, brought to us on Fridays for our guests and our staff by Joe Squared Pizza. So we thank Joe for that. And then we have coming up a history hour, but this is going to be some fascinating stuff here in the second hour of our show today. A look back to after the Civil War to Reconstruction, and we have a particular a local angle, so to speak, to pursue in this hour coming up. The story of a forgotten Baltimore judge whose progressive activism on and off the bench helped blacks after the Civil War and challenged white resistance to Reconstruction in Maryland and in the South. We'll be telling you about that, Judge, when we're joined by Douglas Edgerton, coming up in the second hour of our show today. So please stay tuned for that.